BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with me, Marina Morris. Now, while Tony is away this week at the delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists, let's look into some of Britain's most dangerous state secrets. Risky not because they endanger national security, but because they embarrass the government. The security state, which was set up to identify and arrest German spies in real time, has turned on the Britain's people who paid its wages, and elements within it are putting the very democracy they are supposed to be protecting in peril. How do you know this? In what whistleblowers? And without them, we would know almost nothing about the secret states that bungled so spectacularly in the run-up to the July 2005 London bombings, where 56 people died. Britain's security state is virtually uncomfortable, spending vast sums of public money. The three best-known branches are the security service MI5, which is responsible for counterintelligence or stopping spies or terrorists operating in Britain. The secret intelligence service MI6 is where you will find the James Bonds with a legal license to kill, so long as the foreign secretary has signed off an operation. Only one problem. All those papers stay secret for 100 years. All these services use cover stories and only work on the principle of plausible deniability. That means if an operation is discovered or goes wrong, MI6 can wash their hands of the whole things and, if necessary, fit up what they call patsy or an innocent bystander to take their up. The final one of the three best-known parts of the security state is Government Communication Headquarters, or GCHQ, which is based not far from here in Cheltenham. That is where telephone tapping, email monitoring, bugging and other forms of eavesdropping are monitored. All the information gained is sifted and added to an enormous database known as the Registry, which holds information on journalists and others. There have been 5 notable whistleblowers in the last 15 years, and just about everything these whistleblowers have to tell us would make your flesh creep. Why? Because much of what some elements within the secret state appears to be doing in the 21st century is profoundly anti-democratic. So, who are the 5? First, former MI5 officers David Shaler and Annie Machen. In 1996, they decided to blow the whistles on a £200,000 illegal MI6 plot in February that year to assassinate Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi. 3 or so years ago, in 2008, David Shaler decided to go on a binge of hallucinogenic drugs. He turned transvestite and declared first that he was the Archangel Megatron, then that he was Jesus. Much to delight, one imagines, of his former employees. Annie Machen, however, has kept her head, continuing to blow the whistle to this day. Then, in 1997, came whistleblower Richard Tomlinson. He was an MI6 officer who believed his bosses had deliberately blown his cover. This meant that unbeknown to him, he was walking into a situation where he would almost certainly be shot dead as a spy. Tomlinson managed to talk his way out of the situation and went on to write an enlightening and entertaining book, The Big Breach. His book was finally published in Moscow and can now be downloaded from the internet. However, his most important contribution is a sworn affidavit where he swears to have seen MI6 plans while at MI6 to assassinate Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic in a tunnel using a blinding lights to disorientate the driver, the exact way he believes Princess Diana was killed. Catherine Gunn worked at Cheltman's GCHQ. She blew the whistle on the United States intelligence services and the White House, tapping the phones of other members of the United Nations Security Council in the run-up to the crucial vote on the Iraq war, abusing the secret state, cheating at the most powerful, supposedly democratic table in the world in an effort to get a yes vote for war. This decision resulted in her dismissal, but the subsequent court case was dropped amongst speculation that her defense would call for a debate in court of claims that the war was illegal. We only got one chance to glimpse the truth from the final one of our five whistleblowers because he is dead. Supposedly, committing suicide, he was one of the Britain's most highly respected weapon scientists, Dr. David Kelly. He blew the whistles in 2003 on the so-called dodgy dossier. MI6 Director General John Scarlett and Downing Street Communication Director Alasdair Campbell's infamous fabricated account of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Then, a few days later, as he himself spookily predicted, Dr. David Kelly was found dead in the woods of Humbledowns Hill in Oxfordshire. The gravity of this assassination attempts undermining of democracy and diabolical bungling makes one wonder how many more tragic accidents were waters, mysterious heart attack or terrorist plots were orchestrated by Britain's unaccountable secret states and finance with public money. Tonight we will hear how much of what we see, hear or read in Britain's national press is controlled and filtered, even written by the secret state. This media control operation is a serious abuse of power which gives us a false impression of events. But we start with a man of great courage who died a few years ago in Cuba of natural causes, Philip Agee. He worked as a senior CIA officer in the Middle East and elsewhere for many years and was disgusted with what he saw. Here is this alternative synopsis of why the first Gulf War in Iraq started.
The military spending within the United States was to be continued, and I think that Bush very likely saw the crisis area as the Persian Gulf. What better place could he find than the region where something like 65% of the world's petroleum resources are located? Hussein happened to be just the right guy for this crisis. You know that the United States supported Hussein all through his war with Iran. The CIA gave him the real-time military intelligence on the movements of Iranian military units for assistance to the Iraqi army. The United States became Iraq's largest trading partner with billions and billions of dollars of credits, official credits from agencies like the Export-Import Bank in Washington, in order to provide exports from the United States to Iraq. There were all of these different programs in which the United States was going all out to support Saddam Hussein. Why? Because Hussein at that time was serving as a buffer in his war against Iran. He was preventing the spread of Islamic fundamentalism into the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, keeping in mind that Iran is not an Arab country. But they were very active in trying to foment fundamentalist rebellion through the Shiite populations of the Arab Persian Gulf countries. And so the United States, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia all supported Iraq in the war with Iran. How could this crisis be created through Hussein? Well, one of the ways was to make Hussein think that he could take over Kuwait with impunity. It was quite well known in Washington that Iraq had a long historical claim on Kuwait. Kuwait had, in fact, for centuries belonged to the southern province of Iraq, the Basra province. That was under the Turkish Ottoman Empire. But with the collapse of the Turks after World War I, the French and the British moved into those areas of the Arab world that the Turks had controlled through its empire before. The French mostly into Lebanon and Syria, but the British moved in a very big way in the Persian Gulf. And in 1922, Sir Percy Cox, the British High Commissioner in Baghdad, drew for the first time in history the lines in the sand delineating the borders between Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. And in so doing, he drew the line in purposely, the documentation later proved it, he drew the line purposely to deprive Iraq of a viable seaport on the Persian Gulf. Their only seaport of any importance would be Basra, which is about 60 miles up the Shatt al-Arab, the estuary of the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. Well, the Iraqis never recognized formally the separation of Kuwait from the southern province. And that was one of the historical claims that Hussein had had and the Iraqis had had all along. In 1961, when the British, who had created no less than 10 colonies in the Persian Gulf, including Kuwait, in the 20s, when in 1961 the British gave independence to Kuwait, the Iraqis massed troops along the border with Kuwait, threatening to take the territory back by force, and the British then rushed military forces to Kuwait and the Iraqis backed down. But the Iraqis threatened to do the very same thing in 1972 and 1976. So there is this long, fairly long historical claims that the Iraqis have had on Kuwait for since the 1920s. But there were more immediate grievances as well. One was Kuwaiti overproduction, which had forced the world oil price down, and it was strangling the Iraqi economy going into July of last year. Iraq had a debt of something like $80 billion from its war with Iran. Most of that was owed to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, which, as I said, had supported Iraq. The Iraqis wanted forgiveness of those loans. And the Kuwaitis wouldn't do it. There was also the question of overproduction, which I mentioned just a moment ago. In 1986, the OPEC countries had set $18 as the world price for oil, and they had set quotas for maintaining that price. But the Kuwaitis and the United Arab Emirates had for a long time been overproducing, which had forced the price way down to as low as $14 a barrel and $12 a barrel last June. Well, this was costing the Iraqis huge amounts of money, and they were in a they were being strangled economically because of that, and they could not even pay their debts. Well, this happened to be the best price that the Western industrialized countries like the United States had been getting in constant dollars for the past 40 years. That was another grievance. And the third grievance was the seaport question. Iraq for quite some time had been insisting that Kuwait lease to Iraq two small uninhabited islands called Bubiyan and Warba, which are at the very top of the Persian Gulf, and which are just across from the Iraqi-Kuwait border. And Kuwait refused to do that too. So that on August 1st, Kuwaiti and Iraqi negotiators met in Saudi Arabia. The Kuwaitis refused to compromise, and the next day, Hussein invaded.
It was Philip Agee, former CIA officer in the Middle East. But for the rest of tonight, we look at the staggering suppressed information from just one of Britain's five whistleblowers I mentioned earlier, former MI5 officer and author of the book Spies, Lies and Whistleblowers, MI5, MI6 and the Shaler Affair, Annie Masson.
So just to give you a bit of background on the intelligence infrastructure in the UK, there are three major intelligence agencies. The first one is MI5, which is the agency that Dave and I worked for. That is formerly known as the Security Service, the UKSS, as it's always truncated to. That is a domestic security agency, and it started out looking at espionage and then political subversion. And now it's primarily a counter-terrorist agency, although it still thinks it's primarily an espionage agency, so it works in incredible degrees of secrecy in the way that the police could only dream of. We also have an agency called MI6, which is the James Bond side of things. Well, they like to think so anyway. Although I'd say that on the whole, they are more cheap plonk at embassy receptions rather than swanning around Monte Carlo casinos. They also are supposed to work within the law, just like MI5 is, but seem to manage not to most of the time. We also have something called GCHQ, which is the Government Communications Headquarters, I suppose the equivalent of the NSA. And in fact, they have a very cozy little relationship with your NSA. They have an infrastructure called Echelon. I don't know how many of you have heard of that. It's a wonderful relationship, because in order to follow the law, GCHQ has to get warrants to intercept any UK telephone numbers. And I understand the NSA is supposed to do the same thing if they want to intercept US telephone numbers. Well, they used to. I know it's changed slightly recently. So in the past, of course, GCHQ would intercept all the US stuff, the NSA would intercept all the UK stuff, and share everything. It was wonderful. Wonderful little sidestep around the legalities that are supposed to protect our civil liberties.
That was Annie Mashan. 6:20 in studio. Martin, the Americans are tapping our telephone calls. Is this credible?
I think it is credible. I mean, Annie mentioned Echelon there. Anybody can go and do a search on a computer, on an internet search, and look up Echelon. It's basically the members of Echelon are Australia, New Zealand, Britain, the US, Canada, I believe, and they've got massive capacity to tap telephones. I mean, just think of the technology that we've got these days. Secret services, and not just the Americans, have the capacity to tap virtually all electronic communications. And frankly, if you want to keep something secret, don't do it electronically, because somebody will be bound to find it.
Annie Mashan and her former partner and fellow whistleblowist David Shaler have a number of serious complaints about our intelligence service that include MI5 files held on government ministers, illegal MI5 phone taps, lying to government, IRA bombs that should and could have been prevented, the 1994 bombing of the Israel embassy in London when two innocent people were wrongly convicted, the illegal MI6 assassination attempts against Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. Let's hear what Annie Mashan has to say about the Middle East and Libya.
But this was the case of two innocent Palestinians who were put in prison, are still in prison. I mentioned this morning at the state terrorism talk. Basically, there was an attack against the Israeli embassy in London in July 1994. And the Israelis had been hassling for increased protection around their embassy in London for the preceding few months, because there had been a couple of rather big attacks against their interests around the world. Now, MI5 had no intelligence to suggest that any Arab terrorist groups were planning an attack against the Israeli embassy. London had traditionally been a sort of safe haven for Middle Eastern groups, because they were given a certain amount of freedom of expression and things. So they didn't think they had either the capability or the intent to carry out an attack in London. So the Israelis are getting quite frustrated about this. They're also, because of this safe haven idea, getting increasingly frustrated at a political network which had been set up by a bunch of immigrant Palestinians. And it was doing very well. I mean, they were really raising awareness about their people's plight. They were raising money and funds and sending them back to the Middle East to help them. So, a bomb goes off. Two innocent Palestinians were picked up. They were part of this support network. And they were subsequently convicted, not of the attack, because they had cast iron alibis, but they were convicted of conspiracy to cause this attack. And it looks like they were set up, they were fitted up, because there was a shadowy figure called Reda Magrabi, who kept swimming in and out of their story. He was never traced, even though he was the one that bought the car that the bomb was in. He's the one who was, you know, all asking them to put themselves in certain places at certain times, which led to the circumstantial case against them, which led to their convictions. But nobody bothered to try and trace him. And I think he was probably an Israeli agent. But the crucial thing that David saw was a report written by a senior MI5 officer. His code name was D91. And he had seen all the evidence and all the intelligence, or crucially, in the run-up to this attack. And his assessment, his view, was that Mossad had bombed their own embassy. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but that's what this guy said. Now, it sounds a bit crazy, but as I said, they wanted increased security. They also wanted to shatter this Palestinian support network, and they did, because these two people who were then convicted, of course, everyone else who worked with them just ran for cover. They went underground, and in fact, the network hasn't been really rejuvenated ever since. I should say as well, one was a young woman called Samar Alami, one a young man called Jawed Botme, both professionals, engineers working in London. And they were both sentenced to 20 years each for conspiring to commit a terrorist atrocity. Now, David went public about this. He said, look, MI5 have a serious considered view that these guys were not responsible in any way for this attack. Now, you think a whistleblower comes forward and actually says this. So immediately, any sense of justice, these two people would have their convictions quashed, and perhaps, you know, if there's evidence implying that they knew evidence, that there'd be a retrial at the very least, but they should be released and the case looked at again. Not in the UK. That would have been vindication for David Shaler, and the government couldn't afford that. So in order to make sure that a whistleblower didn't get any credit in the national media, they played fast and loose with these two people's lives. They have never been released. They haven't had a retrial. They are still rotting in prison. They've been in their cells now for over 10 years. They've got another 9 years to go, just because the government won't give Shaler any satisfaction. I mean, I just think that is absolutely psychopathic. The final thing I want to talk about from the MI5 years is something that's become known as the Gaddafi plot in the media. And this is really why we started looking at the 9/11 issue as well, because I think this is an early example of state-sponsored false-flag terrorism with a view to invading an oil-rich Middle Eastern country. As I said, David was the head of the Libyan section in MI5, and he, rather unusually, built up a very good working relationship with his counterparts in MI6. Now, I say it's very unusual because the two agencies loathed each other. Absolutely. They were competing for the same resources, they were competing for profile in front of their political masters, and they had very different cultures. MI6 was very patrician, grand public schools like Eton, Oxbridge colleges, that sort of thing. MI5 was more sort of minor public school, grammar school, Oxbridge, red brick, whatever. So there was a sort of classist issue there as well. It's terribly British. And in this case, MI6, as I said, David had a very good relationship with his counterparts in MI6. So they did tell him what they were up to. They officially briefed him on an operation that they were running in Libya. So the detail of this is that in 1995, a Libyan intelligence, military intelligence officer walked into the British Embassy in Tunis and said, I'd like to speak to the local MI6 person, please. This is why they always live in embassies, because, you know, spies know where to find them. Anyway, lo and behold, the local MI6 officer popped up. They had a nice little chat. The Libyan military intelligence officer subsequently became codenamed Tunworth, so I'll refer to him as that now. He said to the MI6 officer that he had a cunning plan. He had a group that had a plot. They were planning a coup against Colonel Gaddafi. But what they needed, crucially, was funding. They needed money in order to buy the equipment, the explosives, the guns, even the jeeps and the tents, you know, to build their camp. But they had a group of people who were intent on deposing and assassinating Gaddafi. And then they would take power, and they would, as a quid pro quo for the help that MI6 would give them, hand over the two Lockerbie suspects, who were at that time wanted for trial in the UK. Now, this was one of the primary objectives of MI6. It was to get the two over for trial. And they've made zero progress over the years. So they really jumped at this. And they started throwing money at this guy. They didn't wait to build a relationship with him. They didn't wait to find out what's really making him tick. And he also confessed to being an associate of bin Laden. So, you know, actually perhaps that reassured them, because of course bin Laden's a known CIA asset, I don't know. Anyway, they started throwing money at this guy, and there were at least two, probably three or four payments of about $40,000 to Tunworth over a period of a few months. He duly went off and bought all his equipment, set up his terrorist camp in Libya, and as Dave wasn't really aware of all this going on, when he was initially briefed about this, he thought it was just yet another MI6 fantasy. I mean, they were always coming up with mad plots and boys' own adventurism and all that sort of thing. And very rarely did they actually go out and do anything. But unfortunately, in this case, they did. And it was in about February 1996, David was sitting behind his desk, and intelligence started coming in from a variety of sources, where Colonel Gaddafi was travelling in a cavalcade of cars. He'd gone out, he was on a meeting day waving their Libyan flags, and a bomb or grenade had exploded under one of the cars. Now, obviously, they didn't get the man. Colonel Gaddafi is still very much alive and the new best buddy of Bush and Blair. The bomb went off under the wrong car, so innocent people were immediately killed in that. There was also a security guard shootout. Obviously, they went in to try and protect their leader. Innocent bystanders were gunned down. It was a massacre. It was horrible. And as I said, obviously, Gaddafi survived. But when the MI6 officer came over to tell Dave about this, and Dave said, well, look, I've seen these reports from the other sources. Was this what you were talking about? And he said, yes, that was our man. We did it. And Dave just said, no, you didn't. Gaddafi's still there. You know, what are you talking about? But they were really pleased they'd actually managed to get something organized, even if they didn't get the result they wanted.
That was Annie Mashan. You are listening Friday Drive Time. Martin, these attempts to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi was more than 7 years after the Lockerbie bombing and 12 years after the killing of policewoman Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in London. Can you believe that our security services assisted an attempt to have a head of state killed?
I can. I certainly can. I mean, we've got evidence there from people who knew about the plot. So we've got, you know, we've got eyewitnesses, as it were. Interestingly enough, I mean, Colonel Gaddafi is very much in the news as we speak. And, of course, Britain is at war with Libya as we speak to try and remove him, although we're not. Of course, the UN resolution doesn't allow us to do that. That's quite clear why Cameron wants to go with it. I think it's very important at this point to review our relations with Libya over many years. So, for example, going back to the 1980s and the Yvonne Fletcher case. Yvonne Fletcher was a young police officer, 19 years old, policing a demonstration outside the Libyan embassy by Libyan exiles who were opposed to the Libyan regime. Pretty similar to the kind of rebels that we've now got rebelling in eastern Benghazi province of Libya. There was a dispatches programme on Channel 4, which came out in the 1990s, which was a two-hour documentary, two one-hour documentaries about the Libyan, about this killing of WPC Yvonne Fletcher. And what that documentary alleged was that the Libyans did indeed plan to fire over the heads of the demonstrators in order to intimidate them. The British had bugs inside the Western Intelligence Services, not just the British, had bugs inside the Libyan embassy, and they knew that the Libyans were planning to use submachine guns to fire over the head of the demonstrators outside. They then plotted, this is according to the dispatches programme, and it was very well researched, and it was shown on Channel 4, as I say. They then set up an observation point near to the embassy, and when the Libyans opened fire over this observation to kill this 19-year-old policewoman. And in one of the most striking things, I remember seeing the documentary at the time, one of the most striking things in the documentary, they had the SAS top ballistics expert on there, and I remember him saying very clearly, it's absolutely clear that the Libyans did not kill the police lady. The ballistics are all wrong. The bullet has come from a different direction. Now, at that stage, Margaret Thatcher was being bullied by the Reagan administration to take a more hard line with Libya. Basically, Margaret Thatcher was not completely bonkers, and she was saying, well, actually, the Libyans haven't done anything to us, and we've got no particular gripe with them. Why would we want to fight with the Libyans? But, of course, after the killing of WPC Yvonne Fletcher, her attitude hardened, British public opinion hardened, everybody presumed that the Libyans had done it, and so on. But what this documentary showed, possibly, it's an allegation, is that this, in fact, was carried out possibly by the Americans and by the British security services to create Libya as an enemy. And this is what this documentary alleged. And of course, if you're talking to people in Belfast and so on, the idea that the British get up to dirty tricks is like, it's not even a question. We were talking about the Mau Mau in Kenya earlier. You talk to those people, do the British get up to dirty tricks? The answer is yes. Everybody gets up to dirty tricks. The British are no different. So we then come to the Lockerbie bombing. Before we come to the Lockerbie bombing, the effect of the shooting of WPC? No, the Lockerbie bombing. I've got to get the chronology right. The Lockerbie bombing took place after an attack on a discotheque in Germany, at which US Marines were enjoying themselves with local girls or whatever. A bomb went off and a couple of people were killed. Two US Marines were killed. The Western intelligence services intercepted what appeared to be an instruction broadcast from Libya to a cell operating in Berlin to carry out the attack. But we know from Viktor Ostrovsky's book, who used to work for Mossad, he was a Mossad agent, and all of these things can be checked, by the way, listeners. You don't have to take our word for it. If you've got a computer and you've got the internet, and as long as you take notes, you can go and check all this for yourselves. But Ostrovsky said it was actually Mossad which had carried out the bombing, and also had a team inside Libya to send a message to Berlin to make it look as if the Libyans had done it. So we've now got two situations where the Libyans have been set up, one by the British, one by the Israelis. And then, of course, there was a bombing raid on Libya. Yeah. In actual fact, the French Secret Service and the French government would not allow the planes to overfly France. So they flew from Britain, round Spain, past Gibraltar, and then bombed Libya, killing 100 and some odd people in Gaddafi's entourage, including his adopted daughter. Now, all of this, again, the suggestion is that this was all Libya being set up by the Western intelligence services to be the bad guys. Incidentally, when we come to the Gaddafi plot, as mentioned by Annie, the group that they were working with to carry out this assassination attempt on Gaddafi, as she mentioned, had contacts with Osama bin Laden, and they were known as the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. So this is before 9/11. The Western intelligence services, according to Annie Machon, were working with Al-Qaeda to destabilise Gaddafi. And there are certainly Al-Qaeda elements in this rebel regime which has been set up in Benghazi. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are, in fact, providing most of the foot soldiers for the rebel regime. Now, it may sound strange to people out there in Bristol that the Western intelligence services are working with Al-Qaeda, but in the Middle East, it's well known that the Western intelligence services work with Al-Qaeda. If you think where Al-Qaeda came from, it was set up as a group to send Islamic fighters to Afghanistan to fight the Russian army, or the Soviet army. And many of these fighters came from this area of Libya, which is now under the control of the rebels. In fact, Deraa in the north of Libya has got the highest number of jihadi terrorists of any place on the planet, apparently, according to a West Point report, West Point being the US military academy. Now, all of this sounds very convoluted, but in a way it's not that convoluted. People want to make wars because they make money out of the wars, and they make money out of capturing the oil or whatever it is they're trying to do. And of course, most ordinary people don't want wars. They want a quiet life. They just, like, why should we go to war with somewhere? Chad, for example, or Libya, or Ukraine, or anywhere. Most ordinary people just say, well, we don't want to go to war with them. So they have to be made to think of these people as dangerous enemies. And that's why these kind of tricks are pulled. Gaddafi is not a very nice man. I wouldn't like to live in Libya under Gaddafi, but he has got political support inside the country because he's taken a very tough line with outside oil companies. He's extracted an awful lot of money from them. And, for example, we were talking about student fees earlier with Steve Cromer. In Libya, people can go to university for free, paid for by the government. No fuss, no messing. We're an oil state. We can afford to do that. And they've got the highest standard of living in Africa. And best social statistics. So Gaddafi, although he appears to be slightly crazy, has actually got a solid political base because he's actually looked after his people. And of course, in other parts of the Middle East where the West has been in charge, Saudi Arabia, for example, there's no freedom, no democracy, no freedom of speech, and most of the money ends up in the pockets of Western oil companies. Gaddafi has always been a fly in the ointment as far as the West is concerned. They decided that they couldn't beat him and that they would join him. So eventually Gaddafi agreed that he would accept responsibility for Lockerbie. even though there was no real evidence that he did it. And in fact, there's another documentary, The Maltese Double Cross, which was made by a journalist called Frankovic. Again, all this can be checked. This was a documentary shown on Channel 4, again, which suggested that the Libyans couldn't possibly have carried out the bombing. And if you think about it for 2 minutes, the circuit board, which supposedly led back to the Libyans, was supposedly part of the bomb. But it wouldn't. If a bomb had exploded, there wouldn't be any circuit board. And this all came out. And of course, they're suggesting that a bomb went on a plane in Malta and went through two baggage checks in Frankfurt and in London without a passenger. This doesn't sound at all credible. The reason why al-Megrahi was released recently in Britain is because his appeal was about to come up in the Scottish courts. And it's well known in the Scottish newspapers, the Glasgow Herald and the Sunday Herald, that a Scottish police officer was going to testify that Megrahi had been framed and that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene and planted evidence on the scene. And that was a problem, because of course if that then came out, then there would have to be an investigation of the CIA for perjury and perverting the course of justice. Now that would be very embarrassing, cause all kinds of political problems between Britain and the US. So it's much better all round if he was released on compassionate grounds. Now I think what's happening now is we've got these defectors coming from the Libyan side over to the Western side, and they're saying, yes, we've got evidence that Gaddafi did Lockerbie. Don't forget who these people are. They're very, very similar to defectors from the Soviet side in previous... they tell their handlers what they think they want to hear.
Thank you. Thank you, Martin. Let's listen to Annie's version of how the security services seek to control the press.
The other thing that really shocked me was the newspapers. And I would like to just say a little word about this, because, again, I'm not quite sure what the system is over here, but in the UK... they are very much controlled by the government, spin masters, and also, perhaps less well known, by the spies. A lot of the people who have jobs on big national newspapers tend to have gone to the same type of schools, same universities, as a lot of the people who go into MI6. MI6 has a dedicated section called Information Operations, IOPS, which plants stories in the media, which then, of course, become facts as people look at them and do research into them. Also, they have nice cosy little lunches with the editors of national newspapers where they say things like, you don't want to listen to Shayla, old chap, you know, he's a Walter Mitty character. He's a fantasist. He's got a grudge, all that sort of thing.
In the 70s, there was a committee called the D-Notice Committee, which was made up of senior journalists in the UK. And it was there to officially protect national security. But effectively, it meant that it was there to block stories about intelligence activity and operations by MI5 and MI6. So it's a bit of a strange concept that we can have the media effectively doing the bidding of the spies in this country to suppress legitimate stories.
Martin, do we have a free press?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mentioned those documentaries earlier by Frankovic. There was coverage of this in The Observer, for example. So what we have in the West is the truth does get told somewhere by somebody in the end, but most people never get to hear it because, of course, the mainstream press, which most people get their information from, we're not talking about Bristol Community Radio now, we're talking about BBC, ITV, that's very controlled. And of course, with the advent of the internet and the WikiLeaks phenomenon, we are now finding that an awful lot more goes on. We're now seeing much more of the iceberg than we used to see. I think that's to the good, but at the same time, people have got to realise that what intelligence services spend a lot of their time doing is not finding out what's going on, it's telling lies. Yeah, they want certain stories to be told. So, for example, in the run-up to the Libyan business, we were told that the Libyans were using aircraft to repress protesters. And that has been comprehensively debunked by lots of different people. The Russian army gave a statement saying, we were watching all of that from our satellites. There was no air attacks on local demonstrators, on peaceful demonstrators. Now, why would you want to tell a story about air attacks on demonstrators? That would be because you want to put a no-fly zone in. So if you just say they're shooting them with machine guns, there's no cause for having a no-fly zone. But if they're using aircraft, then of course we bring in aircraft. But the Russian army made a statement saying there is no evidence whatsoever for the use of aircraft against demonstrators. But most people in Britain probably still believe that aircraft were used. But out there in the real world, outside Britain, nobody believes that. But of course, that's what happens. And that's what's happening now, is that it's possible now to get English language information from different sources. And I think what people need to do is get lots of different bits of information, and then you start to get the idea that things are not always what they seem, and you shouldn't take anybody's word for anything. Everything needs to be checked. But of course, have people the time to do that? No, they're too busy. And of course, the real problem is that a lot of what the media does is entertainment. It doesn't tell people the truth. It's there to make them go back to sleep and forget about it all.
Here is what Annie has to say about the files held on government minister.
One that sticks particularly in my mind was a young boy, I think he was 14 at the time, who had acquired an MI5 file purely for writing into the Communist Party HQ to ask for information and background about communism because he was doing a school project. It sounds ridiculous, but it has serious ramifications for this guy, because of course the file is there for life, it never gets destroyed, and it would have inhibited him taking up certain jobs or getting certain promotions within certain jobs. So, you know, it's not just a sort of little jokey thing, this would stop him doing certain things with his life. We also saw on the other end of the scale though, a number of files on people who were seen as dangerous subversives in the 1970s and 1980s, usually when they were student politicians. These include those well-known radicals, Tony Blair, Jack Straw, until recently the Foreign Secretary, Peter Mandelson, one of our EU commissioners now, John Prescott, the disgraced Deputy Prime Minister, Robin Cook, the late Foreign Secretary, a whole range of people who are now in the government or have been in the government. And we saw these files because, as I said, we were working for F2. We were there during 1992 when there was a general election. And what happens is anyone who stands as an MP in the UK has their name cross-referenced with MI5's database. If they have a file, the file is called up, the file is assessed to see if they are a threat to the integrity of the nation, particularly if they get elected and particularly if they are going to go into the cabinet or the shadow cabinet. This information is assessed, a threat assessment is made, and passed to the new Prime Minister or the new head of the opposition. So Dave and I had an amazing insight into the activities of these people. And I think perhaps that's one reason why they have been so unforgiving about David blowing the whistle. We know particularly that Tony Blair was very paranoid about what Shayla knew when he went public. Intriguing, but I shall say no more tonight. Anyway, there is a serious point to that, because these are the very politicians who are supposed to hold our spies to account. MI5 is supposed to be under the power of the Home Secretary, MI6 under the power of the Foreign Secretary, with the Prime Minister as the overall boss. Now, you know, these guys have files held on them by the spies. They have big fat files full of personal information. Who is in charge of who? Whom, even if I'm going to be grammatical. It's the case of the tail wagging the dog. This is not real democracy. This is undermining the real nature of democracy if our elected representatives cannot hold these guys to account.
6:46, you are listening BCFM Friday Drive Time. Martin, do you think it's significant that security services hold this information on the politician, task this regulating the activities? Or is this a necessary evil to safeguard our democracy from dangerous radicals?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that the intelligence services collect information on politicians. The question is, who's accountable for all of this? I mean, for example, they've been collecting information on Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness because they were, you know, oppositional leaders of an armed struggle against the state. So in a sense, it would be logical for the state to collect information on them. The question is, who guards the guardians? It's the old question. If we're going to have a secret service, are they going to be accountable, or are they going to have an agenda of their own? And of course, what we suspect is that the secret services are not answerable to the politicians. They're answerable to a secret power structure rooted in the military-industrial complex. The people who make money from weapons, the people who invade countries to take their oil, they are the masters, and they decide what the secret service is for and what it does. Now, the answer to this, of course, is that the Secret Service itself must be under the scrutiny of the police service. And we've just seen this week in Northern Ireland the tragic killing of the Catholic police officer. He is a member of the police service of Northern Ireland. Now, ultimately, what the Republican movement are looking for there is that the police service will be in charge of security in Ireland, not the security services. Because the security services are protagonists. They are the kind of people that go around blowing things up and assassinating people and creating problems. But both sides of the community ought to have faith in the police service. And it's been a tragic incident this week. But I think one of the most positive things about it is the way that both communities have come together. And as Steve was saying in the first half of our programme, Peter Robinson, who's a very hardline Protestant, went to a Catholic church service for the remembrance of this officer. And also there was a dual guard of honour from the police service and from his colleagues in the Gaelic Athletic Association, which is an Irish games association. And until 2001, nobody who served in the police service in Northern Ireland could play Gaelic games. They were forbidden to play them. But that's changed. And there was both his athletic colleagues and his police colleagues were there, and representatives of the other community. So I think the tragic as that incident has been, it has also demonstrated how far we have come towards an accountable situation where the police are in charge, not the security services. And ultimately, that's what it's about. It's about the rule of law. There's got to be rules, and there's got to be rules for the spies as well. And especially if they are engaged in nefarious activities, they should fear accountability, because we will catch you in the end.
So, what happens to MI5 whistleblowers? This is a brief account of David Shaler's imprisonment.
And then we have this wonderful judge called Alan Moses, who just chucked out most legal precedent in Dave's case, just rewrote the legal books. He ensured that when David came to cross-examine the prosecution witnesses, including his former boss who lied to the government, he wasn't allowed to question them freely. You know, adversarial legal cases, you're supposed to be able to test the witnesses, see if they're lying, test their credibility, their character. He wasn't allowed to do it. He had to submit any questions he wanted to ask to the judge and the prosecuting counsel for vetting before he could ask them. So, of course, they crossed them all out. Well, you would, wouldn't you? He wasn't allowed to get the jury to ask questions to determine the facts. The judge told him to shut up. He wasn't allowed to say why he'd done what he'd done. He wasn't allowed to mention the Gaddafi plot during his trial. And when it came to the jury making their decision, the judge ordered them to convict. Now, I noticed there was a young chap handing out leaflets about jury nullification earlier. Absolutely, it's a good move. But we had that in the UK as well. There's a legal precedent. It was laid down from a case in the 17th century. Chucked out, just like that, on the whim of one judge and the MI5. So it overthrows 300 years of legal case history, just like that. And nobody in the media made a fuss about it. They didn't care. It was just crazy. So the judge ordered the jury to convict, and they did. I mean, they had to. But I have to say, when they brought in the verdict, I was sitting opposite them, and they were, you know, some of them were in tears. They knew that there was a travesty of justice going on. The only time either of us was ever allowed to say anything about why we'd done what we did was after Dave's conviction. They bailed him overnight. I should point out that he was charged on 3 counts under the Official Secrets Act, so he was facing 6 years in total, not 2. And he went back the next day, and I was allowed to take to the witness stand, and I was allowed to plea for mitigation. And it's the only time either of us ever had a say about why we'd done what we did. And David then got sentenced just to 6 months, thank God. Of which he served 7 weeks and then did another 7 weeks with an electronic tag around his ankle. But I have to say as well, when he went to prison, he was put in Belmarsh high security prison for most of that time. This is where the internees, the Al-Qaeda suspects, are put. This is where terrorists go and serial murderers and people like that. And he was left there for weeks. I think they were hoping that something would happen to him. However, for some inexplicable reason, a rumour went round Belmarsh saying that David Shaler was a former spy. He was trained to kill with his bare hands. I don't know where that came from, but it worked. I'm not going to comment one way or the other if that's true. Anyway, he survived this time. He came out.
Martin, why is protection for whistleblowers important, and do we have the balance about right?
Well, protection of whistleblowers is important, obviously, otherwise we would never find out many of the things that we need to know. And do we have the balance about right? The answer is clearly no. We do not have a rule of law. In this country. That's not because this country is special. The rule of law is very fragile in many countries. And just to mention, you remember a few years ago, Mr. Litvinenko, who died for polonium poisoning here in Britain, he was a whistleblower against his own security services, and he paid the price. And now, what was really going on there, we're not sure. But it's not just in Britain that these things happen. But it's not, Britain is not immune from this kind of thing either. Britain is a country like every other country, and it's run by human beings with all of their failings and foibles. We can't be complacent about the fact that the state has too much power. Because of the war on terror, we've actually seen police powers massively extended, and there's all sorts of questions to be asked about that. As we saw earlier, we're going to war with Libya, and it could well be on a completely false prospectus which has been set up by our own security services. And people who say that's a conspiracy theory or scary or not credible, you just have to think about who you are and where you live. People in Northern Ireland are very well aware that Britain, the British security services, engage in this kind of thing. People who live in Libya are very well aware of it. I was in, you know, if outside in the world bigger than Britain, we're not always seen as the way we'd like to be seen. I mean, the poet Robert Burns, the Scottish national poet, I can't remember the exact lines, but he said, "Oh, what gift the beastie gives to see ourselves as others see us." We always see ourselves as cleaner than clean, whiter than white, always doing the right thing for the right reasons. Frankly, that's not how we are seen in the world at large, and it's for our own good. It's for our own good to recognise that we are no worse and no better than anybody else.
Thank you, Martin. And now we can see again what do we have about next week's show. Next week's show, Murdoch's journalists are arrested for phone hacking at the time when the government relaxed the laws on media ownership, given Sky News, the majority of commercial TV news. Is the fox in charge of the chicken? Do please join us Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week. Then Tony will bark as usually. And don't let the banksters get you down. Thank you for our guest, Steve Combe, Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, and Oxford economist Martin Summers. And now we are going to listen Russia This Love by John Barry.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to love. I must return from Russia with love. I've seen places, faces, and smiled for a moment, but haunted me so. Still my tongue tied, young pride would not let my love for you show. In case you'd say no, to Russia I flew, but there and then I suddenly knew you'd care again. My running around is through. fly to you from Russia with love.
It was John Barry from Russia This Love. I'm Marina Morris. I'm not from Russia. I'm from Ukraine. And now we will listen Elvis Presley, Suspicious Mind.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see?